satisfy your literary cravings. Welcome to the Bookworm Banquet Show with your hosts, JD and Nicole.
Hey there, Bookworm. Thanks so much for tuning in. Real quickly, want to mention show notes for this episode can be found at bookwormbanquet.com/12. We've got a lot of great stuff lined up for you in this episode.
On this episode, we're going to review a young adult fiction series called Dream House Kings by Robert Liparulo.
Oh, that's going to be fun. And Nicole has a fact about a name change. I'm not sure what this is all about, but I've also got a tip that is about a cool way to keep track of your own personal library, you know, for when you want to loan books out and then they just never come back. Well, with this tool, that won't happen. So
now, that's something I know nothing about.
Your books always come back to you, huh?
No, I think it's usually the other way around. I borrow the book and never give it back.
Yeah. I know this from personal experience.
Hush now.
By the way, are you done with that Christmas sweater book yet?
Do I still have that? That was from like, what, 3 years ago?
Something like that.
Oh, we shouldn't be sharing all this.
Hey, before we jump into the main content, I wanted to run this by you. I found this article the other day. It is about the only library in the world that operates in two countries at once. Have you heard of this?
No, I have not.
This is really cool. It's called the Haskell Free Library and Opera House.
Wait. Library and Opera House?
Yes.
Like a legitimate library that also has operas?
That is the case, yes. The library is on the first floor and the opera house is on the second floor. Very interesting.
They can't be open at the same time, can they? Like, I'm just seeing somebody trying to quietly study in the library while, you know, Pavarotti is singing upstairs.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I don't know the specifics of what kind of, what the arrangement is, but can you guess which country's borders this library is on?
And you said it's actually, like, owned by two countries, or it's found in two countries?
Well, it operates in two countries at the same time.
So these countries obviously have to be closely connected, I would assume.
Mm-hmm.
Is it in Europe?
It is not.
Oh, I feel like we're playing Clue.
It's North America.
It's in North America? Okay, well, that leaves me with just a few options. Can I throw the United States in as one of them?
Yes, that is one of them.
Okay, so we only have two countries that border. I'm going to go with Canada, the United States and Canada.
Ding, ding, ding.
Where is this place? Yeah,
so it is on the border of Vermont and Quebec. The official line there, for some reason, it kind of goes back and forth. It's not straight. So for some reason, the border was very fuzzy for years at that point. So the building got constructed right on what was eventually the border. So for a couple hundred years, this library and opera house has existed right on the border of the U.S. and Canada. So, but it still functions. And one funny thing is that if you are on the second story and you're in the auditorium of the opera house, most of the seats are on the Canadian side while the stage is on the U.S. side.
That's amazing. Okay, so I have a question. Okay. If you are living in the United States or Canada, do you actually have to bring your passport to the library or the opera? Because how do you know which country you're in at any time?
Exactly. And that is one thing that they had to really think about lately. Well, I mean, not lately, over the past year since 9/11, when border security got a little bit tighter.
Yeah.
Right in that area, there are checkpoints and everything like that. But the library itself, you can still go in and out, and it's like a neutral zone.
That is just amazing. But you know what? To me, that really like symbolizes the relationship between the United States and Canada anyway. I mean, we have the longest demilitarized boundary in the world. So, hey, go us.
It's funny because there's a quote from the article here says, while Canadians are guaranteed safe passage to the library, it's a bit of a harrowing journey. To enter, they have to walk past a series of security cameras on Church Street, then past the U.S. border guard stationed out front.
Oh my goodness.
As long as they collect their books and walk back the way they came, everything is fine.
That's just, I feel like we should go visit this library.
I know, wouldn't it be amazing?
Yes, I really think we should put it on our list.
Link in the show notes if you want to read the full article. There's photos of, it's a beautiful, beautiful building. You want to see those photos.
I'm totally going to check it out.
All right. Well, one last thing before we jump into our review. Today's episode is brought to you by Adagio Teas. Now, Adagio is the premier source for loose leaf teas on the entire internet. To find out more, you can click the banner in the sidebar on our website, bookwormbanquet.com, to check it out. Unfortunately, I don't have a cup of tea with me right now, and I am desperately wishing that I had one right now, but it's going to have to wait till we finish this.
Can always go with a cup of coffee, you know.
That's true, too, but we don't have a coffee sponsor.
So. Oh, yeah, that's true. Tea. Tea it is. Please, drink Adagio tea.
So I came across this series of books earlier this year called Dreamhouse Kings, a series by Robert Liparulo. And I was familiar with him because he writes audio drama scripts. And I'm a huge audio drama fan. I can't recall exactly how I found out that he is a novelist as well, and he'd been writing books for years. So I thought, well, I love his audio drama scripts. He's a great storyteller, so he's got to be a good novelist too. So I checked out this series published by Thomas Nelson and absolutely loved it. And so there's 6 books in the series: House of Dark Shadows, Watcher in the Woods, Gatekeepers, Timescape, Whirlwind, and Frenzy. Now, they're all connected, obviously, it's a series, and they all are very reliant upon the previous book, so we're going to try to just review this series as a whole rather than book by book.
It would be a little bit hard, so we're going to do our best to kind of bring to you an overview of what the basic storyline is. It tells a story about a family known as the Kings, who moved to a small town in Northern California where they have no idea of the adventure and terrors awaiting them. There's 15-year-old Xander and his 12-year-old brother David, who make a game of exploring the old Victorian home that they move into. And you know, if it has an old Victorian home in the story, there's probably something a little creepy about to happen. And one night, they discover an intruder, and they follow him into the hidden hallway of doors. And each door transports them to far-off places in long-ago times. But not only can they go from the house to the past, but people from the past can come through into their house. And then someone does and kidnaps their mom, taking her into some unknown place in the past. So the family begins a quest for their mom, which takes them to the most dangerous and fascinating places throughout time. Then the Kings learn a terrible secret. Their being in the house is no accident, and they must do much more than simply find their mother. And it's exactly what it sounds like. Time travel? Yes. Excitement and adventure? Yes. A little bit of creepy, crazy things happening? All of that, check, check, and check.
Totally. Yeah, totally. It tackles time travel in a really different way, too. I've always been fascinated by the concept of time travel, and so I've read a lot of stuff over the years that has some element of that. And most of the time, it's not an unpleasant experience, unless you're talking about H.G. Wells. But, you know, this one, there are some terrifying things that happen when they go to these other places.
Yeah, terrifying. And I feel like most time travel stories are based around the concept of going back in time to change the future. And that's not really the premise that Robert Liparulo takes in this story. So that also was a different turn from normal time travel stories. Not to mention, there's not the time machine that people are used to. You get in something, it takes you back. Instead, the time machine is actually this house and this hallway. And what's kind of neat are you have to have certain things from that time period to actually take you back to that time. So he really was able to be very creative with a very old-fashioned concept. Time travel has been written about going back, you know, a couple hundred years. And so the fact that he was able to take an old concept and an old idea and really put a new spin on it, I thought was very, very well done.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. When I finished it, I felt like, well, there's a few minor plot holes, and I was a bit annoyed with some of the characters and how they handled certain things, but the last book ties up almost everything, and where the story goes in the last few chapters of the last book is just awesome. I really loved how he ties up everything. It's kind of set in present day, but all this time travel, you're jumping around from all these different periods in time. But I also want to mention, though, if you're not a time travel fan, don't let that deter you, because it is a huge part of the plot, but it's not the focal point of the story per se. It's very character driven, and the relationships between the characters are really the overall high point, I think.
I know, and I think that when you're thinking 6 books, he wrote 6 books about time travel. A lot of the time traveling actually goes back to the same places. And even though the kids and the family are jumping from world to world, per se, you're not like meeting a new world in every book, even though he does hit a lot of different time periods and a lot of different places. It's not so overdone that every book is like based on a different place in time. So he kind of keeps it narrowed down so you're not completely inundated with every moment in history, but keeps it interesting enough that you really get a taste and a feel for a lot of those different places, as well as developing his characters through a lot of very stressful, high-action, intense moments.
Yeah, and sometimes I felt like the circumstances just really pushed to the very limits of believability and how somebody would actually react in a situation like that. So that was a little bit on the fantastical side to me sometimes, but I kind of chalk that up to this is geared to the YA market, and so they got to have a page turner, one that's continuously nonstop action, maybe. I don't know. Am I off on that?
No, I think you're right. I think one of my bigger criticisms comes from the fact that I'm just an older adult. And so as a mid-30s lady, I got a little bit, I wouldn't say irritated, but just it kind of got a little bit old after a while for me, the constant near-death experiences and the constant right at the brink of, you know, gonna lose it, and then, you know, the at the last second saving the day type thing. But for a 13, 14, 15 year old teenager, that's excitement for them. And if you're going to keep young people's attention, it has to be fast. It has to be swift moving. It has to be constantly on the edge of your seat. And writing for a young adult audience, Robert Liparulo does a fantastic job as far as keeping the energy going. Now, as I said, as an adult, I probably would have liked a little bit more substance as far as dialogue and storyline and more emotion, perhaps. But for a young adult audience, he wrote it perfect for that particular age group. So if you are an adult that's going to be picking up this book, please keep that in mind. And don't let that deter you from actually finishing the series, because by the time you're done, it is a satisfying read.
Well, yeah, so that's nice to get a little confirmation on that, because I was thinking, you know, well, maybe it's just I'm not in the target demographic.
Yeah.
I'm being a little bit more picky than they might be.
When it comes to reading, I find that teenagers don't tend to be too picky about what they're reading. If it keeps their attention, then they're going to read it. So this will keep their attention, and I would bet that his young adult audience is rather large for this particular series.
Well, judging by the amount of comments on the series website and all the feedback on there, I would think you're right. They were eagerly awaiting every single book. So I should mention also that the first three were published in 2009, the last three in 2010. So obviously there was a several month gap, and I don't know exact dates, so it could have been as much as, you know, 18 months or more from the time the first book was published and then the last book. So I can relate to that feeling of waiting for the next book in a series and wanting to know what's happening, because each book ends very, very abruptly. There's nothing tied up at all. So it was obvious that this is a series and we're not going to get a resolution until the end.
Oh, yeah. I have waited for over a year for the next book to come out in certain series that I have read. There's nothing more frustrating when you get to the end of a book and you are absolutely in love with the characters and so emotionally connected to the story, and the author leaves you with what they call the cliffhanger. And then you have to wait. And Robert Liparulo was smart to get his books coming rather quickly. 6 books in 18 months, that's pretty fast. And so he was able to get his books out there because he is the master. I will call him the master of the cliffhanger. I mean, he purposely left you, wait, what? Wait, you can't just leave me like that. What happens next? It was very smart of him to get his books quickly done, because he purposely, I tell you, did not end his stories right.
Interesting tidbit, because that fact kind of bothered both of us as we were reading or going through this series. And so I actually stumbled across a note that he had posted on his website. Website is dreamhousekings.com, by the way. He said that most of the readers who had written to him seemed to enjoy the cliffhangers at the end of each book. They kind of liked that anticipation for what's going to happen next. And so he said that's one of the reasons why he decided to structure the story that way. Another reason was that it's just a huge story. It's big, and it just couldn't be told in one book. And he said, or even 2 or 3 books. So it seemed logical to just kind of break it up like that and let it pace out the story. And he did a poll and said that 51% of the respondents said that they liked the cliffhangers. So again, we're not in that target demographic, so I think you nailed it. He did it quite intentionally and did it rather well.
Yeah, he did. And the other thing I want to note, for those of you that you think about 6 books in a series, some people don't like to read series, don't want to get committed to reading a whole series. These are not difficult books to get through. They're not tedious. They're not very long. But the other thing I want to note is, even though it's the same storyline, what JD just said there about the story being so big you couldn't tell it in 1 or 2 or 3 books is entirely true. Every book was different in some way. He either brings in a new character, or there's a whole new twist on the story, or it takes a different direction. So you're not reading the same story over and over and over again, which there have been some series that they do that. And so people lose their interest. And Robert Liparulo does not do that. Each book is different and unique in its own way, and has, even though it's the same storyline, they are very, which is very different.
To build on your point there about the different things that, or different themes even, that happen in each book, you can see that those themes reflected in the titles of each book as well. And so every book, he's unveiling a little bit more about why they're in this situation. What's the deal with this house anyway? And why is it here? And this kind of thing. So he's just, peeling back the layers of this story slowly as you go throughout the series. So that is really what kept my attention. And again, the characters are very compelling, and I really felt a connection to the characters, and they were very likable. They were developed well, and was really well done.
The boys in the book, Xander and David, are brothers, and they are very distinct personalities. And Robert Liparulo does a fabulous job of not overlapping their personalities, keeping them very distinct characters, very unique in their own right, and manages to keep their characters very strong through the whole thing. And that's hard to do when you're writing 6 books. And he does a very good job with all the characters. There are several characters in these books, and every single one is distinct, unique, and I will say lovable in their own way.
Yeah, I would agree. We did mention this a little bit. There is some not overly dark scenes, I wouldn't say, but there's some creepy stuff that happens. Well, I mean, you even said that you had some nightmares from this series.
So. You're not supposed to tell those things, JD. No, I'll be honest. There were a few scenes that I, as an adult, got a little bit scared. We mentioned it in the overview. Some creepy guy comes walking into your house and kidnaps your mom. Yeah, it's a little bit creepy. And he's very good with the visuals. And so when you're reading this and you can see it and you can feel it and you can hear it, it can be a little bit disturbing. So parents, if you're going to allow your children to read these books, just make sure that you're either near them or you have read it before them or with them, because there are a few things. And not to mention, there are a few, like we've mentioned before, near-death experiences that can be a little bit unsettling for younger readers.
And I'll admit, hey, there was a couple times where, because I actually listened to the audiobook version, so I didn't actually read the books. And so I was listening, in the evening or whatever. I was getting to a pretty intense scene. I'm like, you know what? I'm good for right now. We'll pick this up tomorrow after I get up.
And for a young adult series to be able to affect adults like that should say something about how good this series really is.
And don't take our word for it. Are you familiar with the Goosebumps series?
Oh, yeah.
Did you ever read any of those?
No, because I remember being too scared to read them. I would see them in the library. It was like tons of books.
Yeah.
And just the covers. I was like, not picking it up. Not picking it up.
Yeah. So I didn't read very many, just a handful. But there are some really weird, crazy, creepy stuff in there. So those books were written by R.L. Stine. There's a quote from R.L. Stine, who is the author of those books. And they said, quote, "If you like creepy and mysterious, this is the house for you. Every room opens a door to magic, true horror, and amazing surprises. I loved wandering around in these books. With a house of so many great haunting stories, why would you ever want to go outside?" Unquote. And I thought, that's the perfect summation of this series.
Yep, R.L. Stine got it right. It is creepy, mysterious, and yet so very exciting. You're almost sad when the series ends.
Yes, yes. And I love that whenever you feel like you can connect with the characters on such a level that you're sad when the series ends. It's an interesting, bittersweet feeling that I think only a reader can relate to. There are a lot of moral lessons that the kids learn throughout this whole ordeal. And so I do think that there's not all this crazy, scary stuff happening just for the sake of it. I mean, it is, but there are some lessons or morals that can be gleaned from the stories as you're going through them as well. So I think that's a redeeming factor.
Absolutely. It's not just an adventure tale. It has some very underlying truths to it. The point is made, but the way that the author makes the point is more subtle, and so it'll get you in the end.
So I'm going to say that my recommendation is it's perfect for that YA target demo, but I don't see why an adult who enjoys good stories wouldn't enjoy them as well, because I did.
Absolutely. I actually think this is fairly reasonable for 12, 13, 14-year-olds as young as that. But I actually think this would be a fun series for a family to sit down and read together just because of the excitement. And it is about a family. And so it might be kind of a cool story. If you're looking for something to read to your kids or you need some family time together, this would be a great series to read together.
I agree. So how many bookmarks are you giving this one?
I'm going to rate the Dreamhouse King series 4 out of 5 bookmarks.
Oh my goodness, we did it again. I'm going to do the same. Four bookmarks out of five.
I'm going to need you to change your ratings. That just shows you that we obviously liked these books and agreed that you should read them too.
So I'm also a fan of instrumental and classical music as well. I think you are too, right, Nicole?
I love classical music. In fact, it's usually playing in my car and I get to the symphony as much as I can.
Now, stay with us on this. This is not a rabbit trail, but there was a composer who loved this series so much that he wrote a few pieces of music that were inspired by the kind of the thoughts and the emotions that are presented in these stories. And I happened across this on the Dreamhouse King's website, and I absolutely loved this music. Turns out he has uploaded some of the longer tracks to his SoundCloud page. I just was like, man, this is such good stuff. And I thought it totally captures the feeling of this story extremely well. His name is Jonathan Miyoko. I reached out to him and said, hey, I want to share your music on the podcast because we're talking about this series. And he said, absolutely, go for it. If you're a music fan like we are, I'm going to play a little clip of this. I think you'll get the idea of what you can expect from this story just by listening to this clip.
And JD, before you play that, I just want to say, if our review wasn't good enough to get you interested in this particular series, this piece of music should be enough to rope you in.
Oh, and I could just keep letting it play because I love it so much. But it's so good. So link in the show notes if you want to check out Jonathan Miyoko's music. He actually has a few albums of all instrumental music as well if you want to check out more of his stuff, which I highly recommend that you do. It's really great. Cinematic and just like epic music. Well, that's actually the name of one of the albums is Epic Music, so... Highly recommend you check out that. And a quick reminder that today's episode is brought to you by Adagio Teas. It is amazing to just kick back in an armchair with a good book and a cup of tea. I absolutely love doing that. They have all different flavors. They have black tea, green, chai, herbal blends, or you can create your own custom blend, which we have done. There's a Bookworm Banquet blend on the website, which we've gotten some good reviews on. So I came up with that blend all by myself. And people seem to enjoy it.
You did a very good job, JD. It is a very good tea.
It's got some apricot and vanilla and almond in there. I really like it. And like I said, we've had some reviews on the site that people seem to enjoy it as well. So check that out. All of their blends and regular loose leaf teas are all at their website. You can find that by clicking the banner on our website, bookwormbanquet.com.
Tidbits about authors, their lives, and their work. It's Nicole's Bookworm Fact.
At the beginning of the show, we gave a little teaser about what my fact would be about, and it was a name change. One of the most famous authors of American literature, actually, when he was well into adulthood, decided to change the spelling of his last name for reasons that nobody can actually prove, but everybody speculates. And for the historical record, everybody's going to say this is the reason why. That famous author is Nathaniel Hawthorne. You know him for writing some very interesting, kind of dark, religious, philosophical books. I'm going to get into that in just a minute. But Hawthorne spells his last name H-A-W-T-H-O-R-N-E. But this is not the original spelling of his name. The original spelling of his family's name was actually H-A-T-H-O-R-N-E, which meant it had no W. So why? Why would Nathaniel Hawthorne change the spelling of his last name? Well, it goes back about 200 years before Nathaniel Hawthorne was actually born to 1692 Salem, Massachusetts. Now, Nathaniel Hawthorne was actually born in Salem. And yes, this is the Salem that, for you history buffs, will recognize from what is known historically as the Salem Witch Trials. If you're not familiar with the Salem Witch Trials, very briefly, it was happened in a Puritan community where some girls actually claimed to be possessed and accused people in their community of witchcraft. By the time they were done with their accusations, this community had actually hung 19 innocent people and 150 more had been accused of witchcraft. Obviously, it all came out later that it was fake, that these girls were not telling the truth, and this Puritan community had all this blood on their hands. Well, it turns out that Nathaniel Hawthorne's great-grandfather was a man named John Hawthorne, who was a judge at the Salem Witch Trials. And they also say that he is the only judge who never repented for his part in the killing of these 19 people. And so, growing up in this environment in Salem, Massachusetts, with this kind of dark legacy over his head, they say that Nathaniel Hawthorne never could get away from the shame of having been a part of this, not just this Puritan community, but the fact that his great-great-grandfather had been one of the judges, that when he became an adult and had graduated from college, he changed the spelling of his last name to disassociate himself with that very dark part of American history. So he never legally did it. He just, from that moment on, everything he wrote and anything he signed, he put a W in Hawthorne. And so his sister would actually go along with that and change the spelling of her name as well. And so how do they know that this is probably the reason he changed his name, even though he never actually came out and said it? If you look at books like his most famous being The Scarlet Letter, that should be indication enough that is about a Puritan community. And most of his writings don't put the Puritan community in very good light. They're usually the villains in the story. They're usually the antagonists in the story. And so a lot of his books deal with the Puritans in a very negative light. So this leads everybody to believe that Nathaniel Hawthorne changed his name to get away from that Puritan legacy. And before I end this bookworm fact, I just want to throw in a few other random facts about Nathaniel Hawthorne I find interesting. He actually was a friend of President Franklin Pierce. They had met in college, and Franklin Pierce is actually the man who found Nathaniel Hawthorne dead. I thought that was interesting. He also went to college with another famous writer known as Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, who at his funeral would be one of Hawthorne's pallbearers and would actually go on to write a poem about him. And then lastly, Nathaniel Hawthorne's youngest daughter was married to a Catholic, converted to Catholicism, and when her husband and son died, she became a nun who ended up treating cancer patients. And the only reason I'm telling you that is because very recently, in 2003, Nathaniel Hawthorne's daughter was nominated for sainthood. So that, ladies and gentlemen, is your bookworm fact.
Wow. I can't say that I blame him for wanting to disassociate with that family member.
No, you really can't blame him for wanting to get away from that part of history. It was embarrassing for the United States and obviously for his family as well. So I don't blame him.
So he didn't actually do it legally, you said, just suddenly started adding the extra letter in there?
Yep, he just added that W, and that's the way he's been known ever since. If you didn't know this part of Nathaniel Hawthorne's past, you would just automatically assume it was always H-A-W-T-H-O-R-N-E.
I love the Longfellow connection, too. Longfellow's one of my favorite poets, so that's cool.
Yeah, and they were very, very good friends.
How many people can say that they had a president be the pallbearer at their funeral?
It was the president that found him dead, and it was Longfellow that was his pallbearer. So close, J.D., so close. If you want another random fact, he was also very close to Herman Melville, too, who wrote Moby Dick.
Ah, yes. One of my favorite classics. Wow, lots of connections. The literary world was pretty small back then. So, I mean, there's obviously going to be some connections.
Oh, yeah. And boy, he was connected.
Splendid fact. I love it.
Random recommendations for readers. Here's JD's bookworm tip.
Well, as I mentioned at the top of the show, I've got this great tip for you, and it is a tool called TinyCat, and that cat stands for catalog. Now, way back in episode 0, many moons ago, I mentioned a tool called LibraryThing. Now, this is a tool which allows you to catalog your own personal library. It's just basically a personal tool for you to just keep track of your own books. You know, I'm sure any avid reader has been at a secondhand bookstore or a thrift store, and you're like, oh, do I have this book already? I know, you know. And so it's like, it's perfect because you can pull up the smartphone app and just double check. Especially, I love Louis L'Amour, and so I got a ton of his books, almost all of them. But I'd be at a store and I can't remember which ones I'm missing. I've read them all by checking them out of the library over the years, but I wanted to own them, you know. And so it's a really great tool for keeping track of that. Well, LibraryThing introduced this new part of their services called TinyCat, which it's designed for small libraries. So say you have a small organization, a church library or a private school library who needs to manage your books, or it even gives you the full patron and account management tools. So you can actually set up accounts for people to check out books and everything. There's an online catalog so they can check to see if a book is checked out, everything like that. And it's all a great tool for free. Now, they do give it for free to individuals. So I have a huge library. Right now, I've got cataloged over 600 volumes, and I have all of them in LibraryThing. Well, I activated the TinyCat portion of that, and I can give that URL to my friends, and they can see all of my library books, or all the books in my library, and if they want to borrow them, they can check them out, and I can keep track of who has which books. So it's a fun tool, and it's free. And I also wanted to mention this, not just for personal usage, but, you know, I'm sure we have some listener who might be associated with a private school or something, and they might be able to utilize this tool. So I just thought this is a really cool thing, and somebody's got to find this interesting as much as I do.
I actually am finding it very interesting. I would love to use that for my own personal library because I run into not even knowing how many books I have, much less how many titles of the same book. I run into that problem too. Why do I have 3 copies of this book? So this would be a good tool for me as well.
Yeah. Like I said, I mentioned LibraryThing way back in episode 0. And so I've been a user for many years, but I never actually got around to entering in all the books that I have. I still don't have all of them. I've probably got about 90%, maybe 95%, because I know I still have some in boxes elsewhere that just wouldn't fit in on my bookcases. But as I was over the last couple of months trying to get everything cataloged, I did come across that. I'm like, oh, I've got 2 of this and 2 of that. And so it's a really cool tool. But because it ties into TinyCat, you have to catalog everything on the LibraryThing side, and it automatically updates in that online catalog for TinyCat. It's really cool. Link in the show notes to check that out. I have already set up an account for you on my library, and I've checked out that book that you've had for 3 years, and it is overdue.
Oh, do not tell me what my charges are. I don't know if I can afford it.
Invoices in the mail.
Man, I'll just buy it at this point.
Before we let you go, I did want to mention real quickly that if you are a fan of J.R.R. Tolkien, I just found out not long ago that there's a brand new volume coming out by him, never been published. It's a story that was edited by Christopher Tolkien, and he put together a backstory that has been referenced in other works over the years, and I guess was a large part of the Silmarillion, which I actually have not read yet, and I need to. The book is called Beren and Lúthien, and it's this story that, like I said, has been kind of hinted at, but now it's been fully fleshed out using some documents that Christopher found that were never published before, and they were bits and pieces, and so he kind of put it all together, filled in the blanks from conversations that he had had with his dad as well over the years, and kind of put it together in this volume. So it was just published recently. I've got a copy. I'm only a few pages in, and it's very, very interesting. So we'll see how that goes. Keep an eye on bookwormbanquet.com for more information about that. I'll be posting a review, a short review, sometime over the next few weeks. But I thought I got to mention that on the show because I'm sure there's some Tolkien fans out there.
Who isn't a Tolkien fan? That's what I want to know.
And also on the website, speaking of our website, I've been posting book reviews on a regular basis now, so check those out if you haven't visited the website lately. Trying to get some new content on there at least once a week, so whether that will be a book review or a new, you might be a bookworm if, quote card or something along those lines, there'll be new content on there every week. So if you want to subscribe, you can click the button on the sidebar, which will automatically notify you every time there's a new post on the website.
And while you're there, please make sure that you leave us some feedback, or you can email us at feedback@bookwormbanquet.com. We do have a feedback line. Feel free to leave us a message at 623-688-2770. And once again, you can do all of this at bookwormbanquet.com.
And again, show notes for this episode, links to everything we talked about, is at bookwormbanquet.com/12. We will see you next time. Thank you so much for listening. Bookworm Banquet is a production of Porchlight Family Media. Our theme music was composed by Sam Avendano. Bumper music by John DeLay and the 41 Players. Our announcer is Janessa Cooper. The program is produced by J.D. Sutter, with editing and post-production by Christopher Green of Greenstream Studio. Our website is bookwormbanquet.com.
Porchlight Family Media,
your source for family-centered content.
PorchlightFamilyMedia.com.